So I'm here with Holger, who is founder and CEO of Blinkist.
Correct, yes.
Sitting in the fairly new-looking Blinkist office. So you guys have kind of got a lot going on at the moment, I guess, with recently raising a round and you're growing pretty fast, I guess.
Right, yeah. We just closed the Series A with Craycroft and eVentures in December last year. Mm. And yeah, we probably know it too. After Series A, or after any funding round, it's always a lot of things are going on. There's a huge backlog of things you couldn't start before you raised a round. Then you have new investors that want to see the numbers going up. So there's a lot of things going on, but it's exciting.
Mm. Yeah. So let's, I guess it makes sense to start at the beginning. So obviously we're here in Berlin. This is the first time I'm actually talking to somebody face to face, which is kind of nice. How did you guys start, and where did the kind of conception of the idea of Blinkist happen?
Yeah, I mean, what we're doing with Blinkist is to bring knowledge to mobile devices, to make it easier for people to fit learning into their daily routines and learn something on the go. We do this by taking nonfiction books and digesting their key insights into a format that you can read on the go. And we had the idea for Blinkist in 2012 because we faced a problem that we were in jobs working 10 hours a day, really busy, and it was hard to fit any learning into our days beyond our jobs. So we would learn a lot on the job, but it was hard to learn something off the job or outside of the job. And it was harder and harder to read all these great nonfiction books out there. And then we thought, okay, let's there has to be a way that makes it or a service that makes it easier to get started with books, to not replace books and only read short content, but to get started with books, to dig into certain topics and then decide where you want to dig deeper into. And based on that problem, we did some research. We didn't find the classic story that we didn't find a service that fulfilled our needs, and thought, okay, Let's do it on our own. There is a huge market, and there are probably more people than us facing the same problem. And that was the start for Blinkist.
It makes sense. One of my goals for 2015 was to read a lot more, and I knew that if I could just manage that, then a lot of things would happen because of that. I would increase my learning, and hopefully a bunch of other things. But I guess in the modern day, like, people have distractions and reading is not as easy as you might think. One of the main things for me that saved me was audiobooks, like enabling me to listen to books when I'm doing something else that doesn't require my brain, like washing the dishes or whatever.
Yeah.
But I guess Blinkist takes that like a step further into actually condensing the information that you're getting out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that audio did the trick for you, because when we launched audio summaries on Blinkist, that also resulted in a huge spike in engagement and users adopting with the service. So when we initially started, we only offered text versions of our blinks, but in December 2014, we introduced audio summaries, and that helped a lot. A lot of more users who initially didn't have the time or, you know, didn't really use Blinkist, then started to use it too. So audio is really important to make it easier to continuously consuming such kind of content, because you have less competition in space, you know, in situations when you're cleaning your dishes or driving your car, and when you can't read, and there's only a small set of services you could use. So audio is really, really important for us. And then if you compare it to a full audiobook or what we're doing, condensing the information, and that's, I guess, the core of your question, what we're doing, we're helping you to fill these smaller times. Sometimes when you have a waiting time of 5 minutes or you have a short commute of 10, 15 minutes, it doesn't necessarily make sense to get started with a full book because a chapter may already require 30 minutes of listening. And so it's hard to break down a book into those short times. And usually people read or listen to books when they have a longer amount of time in a row to dedicate, and we're there, or we provide a solution when you really only have a short time and wanna and still wanna fill that with a learning content or with doing something meaningful other than reading news or checking any social media feed.
So you're a subscription product, obviously, for I guess you're technically a consumer based SaaS.
Yeah.
So users pay a monthly fee to get access to, I guess, all of the titles that you offer.
At the moment, we offer only yearly subscriptions. We decided to offer yearly only because we have a plus and a premium subscription. Plus gives you unlimited reading, and premium includes also the audio versions, a sync to Kindle feature, and a sync to Evernote feature. And yeah, we decided for consumers, it's too complex. If you have two different subscriptions and then say three different terms, like monthly, quarterly, yearly, we wanted to keep it simple, and we did some tests and we saw that the yearly subscription worked best for both for us and for our customers.
Okay.
And
that's interesting, because there's such a discussion at the moment on the enterprise side around kind of billing terms, and I think a lot of people are moving towards yearly, where in the past they would have offered monthly. So
I mean, it always depends. On an enterprise side, a lot of businesses are charging quite high price points because they are solving, like, their service is quite more complex than Blinkist, and sometimes it's hard to commit for a year if we're talking about really high price points. But our subscriptions come for $50 or $80 per year, depending if it's plus or premium. And all customers can test the service for free with all these features for 3 days, and then read one book for free each day. So we have a free plan that showcases the full experience. So basically every user has the time to fully test the product and use it as long as they want before making a decision. And if they're ready to make a decision, then then it's usually not a big problem, although the price point isn't holding a lot of people back, because it's not that much of a commitment for most of the users out there that are in our target audience, which is usually professionals or people with a certain degree of education, so a certain income. They usually don't have a big problem to commit $50 or $80 a year.
One thing I was going to ask was about freemium, and whether, like, did you guys have a discussion around what, like, did you see it as something that was critically important for you to have a free plan or a way for users to kind of use your or try your content for as long as they wanted?
It was really important for us to have a free option, because some people may, when they join, they may not have the time to give the product a try or to test it, and we wanted to provide them something whenever they come back and have the time to give them something that they could use, so they have an incentive to come back, reopen the app, check which book is for free on that day, so we have a kind of an engagement trigger for free users too.
Okay.
And not just leaving users when they decided once that they would not like to subscribe for Blinkist, then if we don't give them any option, then they're lost forever. If we give them an option, a free book a day, they may come back to check the book. And then eventually at some point they may say, okay, now I've been using that free product for so long, and I discovered 5 new books that helped me in a certain way in my job or in my private life. So now it's time. Now I'm ready to commit to subscribe.
Okay. I'm really interested, I guess more on from a tech perspective, like, how on earth do you go about compressing a book? So you offer just nonfiction titles right now. What kind of compression ratio do you do? Like, say I have a book that is, 10 hours long, like, how long does that end up once it goes through the Blinkist machine?
I think it's important to point out that it's not an algorithm that compresses the books, but it's people, experts that read the books and that are experts about the subject matter that the book is about, and then they can judge, okay, these are the key insights from the book, this is what's important on a top level. Obviously we can't cover everything from a 10-hour book in a 15-minute read, but we can cover some of the quite some of the core concepts and give some examples and some of the basics to get to give those who just want to have an overview about the topic, to give them a decent overview, and also to provide those people that would like to dig deeper but still haven't made up their mind if this is the book or if this is the topic they want to invest time in, to give them everything they need to make an educated purchase decision or reading decision if they should really commit to 10 hours of reading the book.
So you have a team or some people that are working on this constantly to basically read a lot of books? And
definitely. We have a team of internal editors, like an editing team here at Blinkist, consisting of the publishing manager who screens all the books and checks all the new releases and also checks classics from the past, who checks all the user requests, and then based on all that information decides on an editorial calendar, deciding like when are we going to publish which book. And then we have the editors who work together with freelancers to get those books written up in Blinks. So the heavy lifting is done by a big pool of freelancers. So for every subject or for every category that we're covering on Blinkist, we have 5 to 10 freelancers who we can call and say, hey, we would like to do this book. Do you have time? And if they have time, then they get the assignment and then work together with one of our internal team to get this book into Blinks in both text and audio.
Okay, so do you guys effectively record your own audio as well? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's. We don't do it in a studio. It's all. Yeah, it's basically. We've set up really nice processes that bring us a quality that is almost studio-like, but without using a studio, because that's the highest or the biggest cost driver a lot of times. So if you can avoid the studio, then try to avoid the studio, because then.
And I think. You don't need to use a studio nowadays. Like, you can achieve 99% of the quality with a home setup, probably at like less than 1/10 of the cost. So
I guess that's what we figured out too. And we did some tests. We have some studio recorded versions, and then have some versions we didn't or had in the beginning. Some versions of both, and then asked customers, asked users to hear the difference. Can you tell which book has been recorded in a studio and which not, and they couldn't. So it was not a decision to offer less quality just to save costs, but it was a decision to offer the same quality with less costs.
Makes sense. And I guess like with speech, it's not so critical, and people are probably listening on crappy headphones or on the speaker of their phone or something. So
And I mean, if you look at all the podcasts that are, so you know, people listen to so much podcasts and listen to this and that right now maybe, and so people are used to not listening to studio quality audio, and that's totally fine. Maybe it's even better because it's more informal. It's like, you know, like you're talking to someone sitting next to you rather than having this quite formal, sterile voice talking.
Makes sense. I guess just starting from the beginning, like, when did you guys launch, and what's been the journey since then?
We founded the company in August 2012 and launched our first beta version in January 2013, only to the German-speaking markets. In the beginning, we only had German content, and then entered into a 9-month beta phase in Germany, Austria, Switzerland. We tested subscription model versus on-demand purchases, so single purchases per book. We ended up with subscription model because that worked better. We tested a lot of different concepts for the app and for the content itself. And then when we kind of had a stable version, when we knew, let's go with this product, with this content format, and with this business model. Then we launched internationally, and that was in November 2013. And together with our core initial product was an iPhone app. We extended to a web app, so everyone could use Blinkist no matter which platform they would use, starting in November 2013, and then launched an iPad app in May 2014, an Android app in September 2014, and then Blinkist Premium, including audio versions, in December 2014. So that was kind of the evolution, like bringing Blinkist to more platforms and also to new use cases with audio.
Sure.
And basically what I said in the beginning, when we launched audio, or when we switched to yearly subscriptions, including adding a premium tier with audio and sent to Kindle, that's what really kickstarted growth. So kind of before November, December 2014, it was like figuring out product market fit, finding the right setup. Mm. And then with the launch of premium, we found the right setup and we're able to scale quicker. And then last year, 2015, has been all about scaling up the product, scaling up the content, scaling up the user base, scaling up the content. And
yeah,
obviously it's always a continuous product challenge to, we're continuously working on improving the product. So that never stands still. And it will be the same in 2016.
Sure. What's your primary kind of method of user acquisition? Like, how are you growing your user base?
We have three pillars. Like one really important pillar is performance marketing. We do a lot of paid acquisition through Facebook, Twitter. We're digging into paid content distribution because content marketing in general. So organic content marketing and also paid content marketing, because the content is at the core of our product, at our business. And so it makes sense to use that for marketing too. We've started this a year ago with a blog called Page 19, and that's been grown organically really well. And now we want to put more focus on that and scale that even further.
What's the focus of the blog?
It's basically things you can learn from books. So Page 19, there is a quote or a statistic we found somewhere that the average reader quits a nonfiction book on page 18. So it doesn't go beyond page 18.
Nice.
And that's what we call the blog Page 19, to go beyond page 18 and to provide insights to nonfiction books, to provide lists of books and every, you know, interesting content around nonfiction books, but in a more web or magazine style format.
Okay.
So we don't just take the links that we offer in our core product and just publish them on a blog, but we write articles that fit better into the environment, into the web environment.
Is it like a separate brand from your core site? It sounds
it's a separate brand, but it's tied to Blinkist. So you can always see it's written by Blinkist. So every content marketer, I guess, has the challenge to provide value with the content they deliver for marketing, but still to have it tied to the core service that earns the money in the end.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do with Page 19 too. It should be a standalone product that provides value to readers, but then obviously it's also there to generate leads for Blinkist that would eventually buy a subscription, because that's in the end what pays our salaries.
Sure. Yeah, I guess it's something that every content marketer wrestles with, is like how far can you separate your content from your kind of corporate site without kind of losing the benefit of bringing users?
Yeah. And we're discussing frequently whether calling it Page 19 is the right way to go, or whether we should call it Blinkist Insights, Blinkist Magazine, like make Blinkist part of the name. In most startups, nothing is set in stone forever. We were quite happy with the momentum of Page 19 at the moment, and we have loyal readers of Page 19, so that brand really has something on its own. But we're also constantly looking at what does it attribute to Blinkist. So and always fine tuning and testing stuff.
What social channels are the most important for you for acquisition?
Facebook, Twitter have been really, really important, and now Instagram is massive.
Okay.
Like,
are you doing paid on all of those? Or?
Yes, I am basically paid. Right? We've never really nailed it on Facebook to grow our community organically there.
Yeah.
Either we've done it wrong so far, or our users are just not on Facebook so much. Yeah. They're not, and that could make sense. And we're targeting professionals who are short on time, who is short on time, who cannot read everything they want to read and want to spend their time, their waiting time is more meaningful. So we want to get them away from, you know, all the time killers on their mobile device into some other content. So it would be, it makes sense that that they are not so active on Facebook.
Mm. They're actively trying to cut down and condense the stuff they consume. But it's
always hard to. Maybe we've just done it wrong. But for paid acquisition worked really well through Facebook and Twitter, and now also Instagram. Instagram opened up for advertisers a few months ago. It's still quite new, so big brands are not on there yet. There's not much competition, so prices are really low, and that helps a lot.
And you're doing like photo placements on there?
Yeah, it's always like the ads on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter are always a picture with a little block, with a little post.
Okay.
Like on Instagram, the post is, I think, shorter than on Facebook and on Twitter, but it's always the same combination, a picture and a quick... quick text, and then these are mobile install ads, so they drive traffic directly to the app store, and then to trigger users to install our app.
Yeah, well, is there anything advice you would give to somebody approaching trying to grow their user base for an app right now? And
I think things
that work really well for you. Or?
Right now, it's really being on Instagram.
Okay,
it's huge. They have the same targeting capabilities than Facebook, so you can deliver or manage those ads through the Facebook interface.
Okay.
But prices are quite low still.
Okay.
So this is this is something that everyone should look into. And we in the beginning, I personally didn't believe so much on Instagram because I thought the audience that uses Instagram isn't the audience that would use Blinkist. But I was wrong.
Yeah.
It's damn wrong.
Something that I've done a lot of thought around is you know, even in the beginning, we thought that Facebook wasn't relevant for us. But I mean, actually, everyone's on Facebook.
Yeah.
Even for an enterprise tool, it makes sense to be on Facebook now because your audience is on Facebook and pretty much everybody is there. And I guess there is a point where probably even for Instagram, it's relevant to do stuff there as well, even for an enterprise, like B2B solution.
Yeah.
Which seems totally counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But it's
so easy to try. So that's because it's so well. I mean, Facebook has a really great ad product. Everyone can use it without a long onboarding. They have a really nice documentation and it's really plug and play. Mm. You can just look into it and set up your first campaign within 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's the same with Instagram. Make a little banner, pick an audience or pick a targeting and then just get started and spend $100 and see what happens. So it's really low effort and definitely worth a try. And it may not work, but then it didn't cost a lot and neither money nor a lot of effort or time going into it.
Sure. Just this is a bit of a random thought. Do you have an audience which would be like students that are trying to quickly absorb information?
We get that asked a lot of times because obviously the job of a student is to read a lot. So we and Blinkist would be could be a great tool for them. We don't focus so much on students for two or three reasons. Reason one is students usually learn with textbooks, like the longer university textbooks, and we rather focus on the more popular non-fiction books that are not used in universities so often. Mm. And because the textbooks, it's hard to summarize them because it's hard to convince them because they are really dense and it's about really every page matters. So we don't offer as much content for students. And then second, students really need to read the full book.
Yeah.
So there's no use case. I mean, if you want to pass an exam and just need some quick information, there's someone who summarized the lecture of the professor that is more useful because it's targeted towards how the teacher asks questions. So we can't be used to pass a test, for example.
Yeah.
And that's not our intention. And then last but not least, willingness to pay. Students are not the ones who are willing to or able to pay. for subscriptions, or not as much. And that's why we're not focusing so much on that. Yeah. I mean, if they reach out to us, if they like the service, we give them a discount. We think that price shouldn't be in the way of someone to learn more. So we're always happy if students reach out. But it's not a target audience we're focusing at the moment.
Okay. I would love to talk about what kind of metrics you guys use to measure your growth, and obviously us being a lot about metrics, I think it's an interesting topic, especially on the consumer side, and how you guys measure those.
Yeah, I mean, we have basically two big fields we're focusing for. There's growth, and then there's product. On the growth side, we're focusing on number of customers and revenue, and then the return on investment of paid campaigns. Since this is a huge, like, we split up the new customers by channel and look at, okay, what channel, like, what is the monthly or weekly attribution per channel, and then for the channels that we pay for, we always calculate a return on investment, and we do that. We calculate a return on investment on a 28-day window and on an 8-month window. Our goal for every paid campaign is to be break even within 8 months. So say if we pay for 100 signups in January and they cost 100 euros, then we, out of those 100 signups, we want to generate 100 euros after 8 months to cover for the acquisition cost, and then every renewal or every conversion that happens after those 8 months would be profit to pay for the overhead for everything else that needs to be paid. And but since it would be quite hard to launch a campaign, then wait for 8 months and see does it work out or not, and then scale it or not, we have some kind of some rules of thumb. We know when we have a certain ROI within a 28-day window, which counts in every euro that we earn from a user within 28 days after the sign up, we can predict if the ROI of that 28-day window is on a certain level, then it will be neutral or positive after 8 months. Okay. So this is kind of how we steer the paid acquisition budget and allocation, and that helps us to make quicker decision on which campaign to scale and which campaign to scale back or pause, and so on. So that's on the growth end. New customers, a number of new customers, number of the revenue, and then the return on investment. Obviously, these are on a company level. If a campaign manager will always also look into cost per install, cost per sign up, and so on, and a CRM manager may look into click rates and conversion rates of certain campaigns. But these are kind of the core metrics we're looking at. We're reporting on a regular basis, also in our board. Then on the product side, we focus on engagement. And engagement for us is monthly active users, but not on an active level, but how many percent of our customers have been active within the last month.
Yeah.
And we're looking at DAO over MAU, daily active user over monthly active user, to figure out the stickiness and to improve that, because if we're stickier, then we're all almost in any time. If you have a higher DAO or MAU, your monthly active user rate also increases.
Yeah.
And last but not least, renewal rate or churn rate. We focus on renewal rate because that's a positive twist, and that also shows us if customers are getting value out of Blinkist and decide to renew, or if they churn away.
Yeah.
So these are the three metrics on the product end.
Cool. Does having a yearly only subscription, do you think it makes it much harder on the kind of renewal rate side?
It makes it easier, actually. We found out that it makes it easier because right now we are at a level that not every customer is using Blinkist on a monthly basis. This is nothing we're happy with, but it's just fact that there are some weeks where you read 10 books, where you really want to, or some month where you read 10 books, where you're really into Blinkist, and then there may be one or two months, especially in summer, where where you don't want to read at all because it's warm outside or because you're so busy in your job that you can't even make time for reading. But that switches. We have users who read it really, who use Blinkist really frequently, who have daily or weekly or monthly habits. But then we also have users who are on off. Okay. Like a gym. If you have a gym membership, there's a lot of people have do a lot of training in 3 months, then have 2 months of nothing because they're injured or whatever, they're lazy, and then they come back. And if you have a monthly subscription and you had 1 month of inactivity, and then at the end of the month you see, oh, my renewal is coming, I haven't used it, so I'll stop it. But if you have a yearly subscription, you're looking back at a full year and you see, okay, I had moments where I used it and I had moments where I didn't use it, but overall I used it a lot and it provided value to me, and so I want to stay. So that helps us a lot. And okay.
I guess it smooths out that kind of seasonality. If you have any seasonality there, it's,
and which is usually for the user, they don't pay more because a yearly subscription is cheaper than if you would pay for month. So would they, in the end, after a year, they pay the same amount than they would have paid if they had been on off with a monthly subscription.
Sure.
But they feel better about it. They have less moments where they think, wow, I didn't use it last month, so I cancel now. From a psychological point of view, it feels better for users. And then from a business point of view, I think it's obvious that it's easier from a business point of view to have a yearly subscription because you get an immediate return on your marketing investment. So you can judge quicker if that campaign works or not. And then you kind of have reliable revenues.
If I look at my Netflix usage, I'm very often like unsubscribing for 1 month or something when I see it that I'm really not using it, or there's no shows that I want to watch right now. And of course, like it's with that, it's so easy to unsubscribe for 1 month and resubscribe again later. But I don't know. Maybe Netflix doesn't care about that. They know that I'm going to come back when there's something that I think
Netflix or Audible is also a good example. Yeah. We've discovered that behavior you've been describing on Audible a lot when we interviewed people, and also for myself, I discovered that. They are so big already, they can they have enough data to know that you'll be coming back, and they can even out those on-off sessions. We're not at that scale yet. I think when we're at the scale of Netflix or Audible, we'll offer monthly subscriptions too. But for now, yearly doesn't hurt a lot of customers, and it helps us a lot.
Do you plan, like, would you always maintain this kind of all-you-can-eat plan and allow users to access everything they want to? Or obviously, you mentioned Audible there. They have like a credit system now where you get one credit a month, which actually I don't like, because if I want to go crazy for a couple of months on books, then I can't. How do you approach that?
I think we don't have any plans in the mid or long term for now to switch from an all-you-can-eat model to a license-based model like Audio. But I mean, I can't predict the future. I don't know what the next years will bring. Maybe there will be good reasons to switch to that, but I don't see those reasons right now. I don't see why we should do it.
Sure.
I mean, Audible has the problem. They need to pay per book you download. They need to pay a fee to publishers because they use the actual book. We only use a condensed version of the book, which actually also has a marketing value for publishers. If you read the links for a book, then you're aware of this book and you're maybe more likely to purchase it than you have been before. And that's why the way how we work with publishers, we also, like publishers we work with, we also pay them a licensing fee. But it's a one-off fee or revenue share. So it's not like we don't pay per download. We don't have to pay a licensing fee per download, which would, if we would pay that, then we would need to think of such a model.
Yeah, okay, cool. I guess one thing I was going to ask was whether you look at the lifetime value of your users.
Yes,
we
do.
Is that something that you measure?
Yeah, I mean, we measure it. It's always a little bit of, we cannot know it for sure. You always look at your at your yearly the yearly price, and then you have a renewal rate from the first year, and then based on those two you try to predict the lifetime value. And then maybe the renewal rate goes up in the second year, maybe it goes down. It's always hard to tell. We have assumptions of lifetime value, but we also kind of cover our downside in a way that as long as we get a full payback within 8 months, within the first year cohort, we don't rely too much on a lifetime value. Even if our assumptions would be completely wrong and it would be only half of what we assume, we wouldn't have a problem because we don't burn money based on what's in 2 years or based on a hypothetical lifetime value, but rather we really grow sustainably in that way, that we only invest into channels that give us a full payback within 8 months.
Okay.
So, but obviously every investor we pitch to wants to know about lifetime value. It's a known concept, but I've recently, or last year, I also read a lot of articles that you should never rely on some lifetime value assumptions.
It's such a topic of debate at the moment, I guess, especially like in the B2B space as well. We've actually found that you can, if you measure the lifetime value, for example, across 1 year, you can actually get much more reliable measurement that way. Although it's not the true lifetime value, it's a lifetime value that can probably like give you much more actionable information. But it's still something that I think measuring it is obviously not easy. And for small businesses with a smallish number of customers, it can be really volatile.
And can be really dangerous if you rely on lifetime value to pay back your acquisition budget or to pay for something. And then it doesn't add up, like then your lifetime value is different because users churn away or you can't upgrade them like you assumed, then you get into big problems. That's why we try to be careful with that metric.
Sure. How do you see the state of the tech scene here in Berlin right now? Have you been in Berlin for a long time?
I moved to Berlin to found Blinkist, to start Blinkist. So I've been in Berlin for 3.5 years now, and it's been a great journey since then for the whole city. I think the tech scene is evolving pretty fast, but I also see that it's still far beyond other ecosystems like in the US, like New York Valley or Tel Aviv. I think. And this is, again, something that probably everyone says, but probably because it's true, we're still lacking a decent amount of exits and experienced entrepreneurs. Like I still talk to a lot of entrepreneurs that are like us, that started their first startup. Blinkist is our first startup, so we have no serial entrepreneur in the team who already started, or in the founding team, who already started 2 or 3 startups and exited one, and who's done all the mistakes before, and who helped us avoid mistakes. We've made the common mistakes on ourselves, and I think you have to do them on your own. Even if you're mentored by someone who's experienced, you can't avoid any mistakes. So a lot of startups or entrepreneurs I know are like me or like us in that regard. It's their first startup, and they're going through all the mistakes. And I think, in 5 years from now, we'll have much more entrepreneurs who've sold their first startup or who've ruined their first startup, who've done it before, and then that will bring, or that will accelerate the growth of successful startups. Because I can almost certainly say that my second startup, I will avoid a lot of mistakes because I've learned a lot with Blinkist. No matter which idea it is, or it would be, the chances of success would be higher. And I think other ecosystems, like the ones I mentioned, already have this. They have this cohort of experienced entrepreneurs who found a new startup and then make it big because they know how to grow it big. And they have they actually, for me personally, you have to get used to the fact that you're actually running a company that is reaching customers in over 140 countries in the world, that is scaling on a global base, and that can become really big. It's something, I mean, obviously you pitch this to investors every time, and you have these nice business plans that have 100 million in yearly revenues in 5 years and so on. But it's one thing to pitch it and to just, you know, make it up. And the other thing to really believe in it, to really say, yeah, I'm doing this now and this is happening. I mean, obviously we always believed in our product and in our capability of scaling this, but I would lie if I would have said that I was completely sure, yeah, we're gonna hit the 100 billion revenue at some point. And I think when you've done it before and you see that certain things, it's always a challenge, but then again, if you know the mechanics, it's not that hard either. If you have the right idea and the right team, then it's just mechanics, then it's just something that a matter of execution. And once you've experienced this, it's easier to think bold from day one and to move faster.
Sure.
And I think this is what's still lacking in Berlin here and there.
Okay.
But that's natural. That just comes with time.
Okay. As a first time founder in Berlin, do you think it's easy, or is there any advice you would give to first time founders here?
I think there's nothing lacking. I mean, every day, obviously, it could be easier here and there from a frame, like some framework. Certain, for example, hiring people outside of the European Union, applying for a visa, that's still a pain in the ass process.
Yeah.
Well, once you know it gets a little easier.
Yeah.
Once you know some shortcuts, but to learn that takes a lot of time because it's bureaucracy, like in almost any other country too. That things like that are tough, but on the other hand. Yeah, you have to deal with challenges everywhere. I don't think that's much easier in other countries.
Sure.
And other than that, Berlin provides everything that's required. There's a lot of office space, affordable office space, a lot of talent, international talent, affordable talent, because costs of living are not that high, and more a really open startup community that is willing to help each other. I've like almost any entrepreneur I met here was willing to share insights, share, you know, what they've learned. So everyone is accessible and everyone helps each other out. But then, I think having more experienced founders will, in the end, also make it easier for first-time founders because then there are more experienced mentors in the ecosystem that may also help.
Yeah, so maybe in 5 years then.
In 5 years. I mean, we're on a good track. I think it's already much better than it has been 3.5 years before, and it will be better in the next 3.5 years. It just needs time and time to evolve.
Cool. Okay, well, I guess we should probably wrap it up, but it's been really cool to talk to you and explore your product. I guess before we go, like, you guys are hiring, I would assume, quite aggressively. So how can people find out more about
Blinkist? I mean, we have jobs.blinkist.com. All the open positions are listed on that page. We have our homepage that covers a lot of information. And if there's any open questions, jobs@blinkist.com or hello@blinkist.com. Like, the people behind those email addresses, including me, can answer all emails, and we're always happy, even if there's no position that fits, we're always happy to meet passionate people and get in touch, and there may be openings coming up soon.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again so much.
And thanks to you, Ed.
Thanks for the coffee.
You're welcome.